Hi, this is Barry Liss at Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science at Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Analysts and pundits who observe the presidential administration and Washington politics rely heavily on polls and straightforward statistics. As it turns out, they may be overlooking the powerful tools that math modelers have been using in industry and sections of government like the military. In today's segment, we speak with Dr. Douglas Samuelson, president of the consulting group Infologix, which works extensively in the nation's capital. Doug, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Barry.
Since the off-year election of 2009, there's been a lot of media coverage about the gubernatorial races in Virginia and New Jersey, which were won by Republicans, and the New York 23rd congressional district, which was won by a Democrat after a split in Republican ranks. What new insights does your analysis bring to these election results, and what might they mean for the congressional election of 2010?
Well, by way of background, let me explain that from way back, early in my career, I was doing precinct-level targeting. That is, statistical analysis of how a voting population breaks down into little blocks and what influences enough of those little blocks to change the result of an election. You can get on the web and Google targeting, and you will find, or precinct targeting, or voting targeting, and you will find firms that claim to have invented this within the last 15 years. This is not so. It goes back to the 1950s. It has gotten much more sophisticated and much more detailed now because of the availability of information online, because of much greater computational capacity. The lists are sold back and forth more freely among different groups. But the basic idea has not changed very much since the early 1950s. You take the population, you break it into segments that are pretty much homogeneous within them. You poll certain of those segments much more heavily because they're the ones that swing, depending on certain issues. Certain segments vote pretty much the same regardless. And then you can assemble from that and some issue polling to those segments what swung whom. Why did this election go the way it did? Now, I didn't do a lot of that for this election, but I'm good enough at it in general to have noticed something in the numbers from the election that maybe some of the pundits missed.
Okay. Want to start with a couple of those things?
Well, I'll start with the state of Virginia, where I live, where we had the most lopsided gubernatorial election I can remember in 35 years.
So I gather.
McDonnell won by 18% of the vote. He was leading in the polls fairly consistently by about 12 to 13% of the vote going into the last week of the election. During the last week of the election, both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama came into the state and campaigned for Deeds, the Democrat. One way to read this is that they cost him another 5% by their endorsement.
That they hurt the Democratic
their endorsement
challenges.
Hurt the person that they were trying to help. That's not the only way to read it. I would have to get much more deeply into the numbers, specifically district by district, to be confident about that. But I've seen it before. When there is a lot of disaffection in the electorate, and it has been expressed by a strong vote for a presidential candidate, often voters' remorse will get inflicted on somebody who is too close to that president or presidential candidate, but isn't him. As I said, I've seen this in races before. There's another factor involved here as well. Virginia is very much a state that likes to think of itself as independent from national politics. Virginia usually elects a governor the opposite party from the sitting president, Democrat or Republican, in the last 30 years. And part of this is a trend that I see nationwide in the few elections we have. There's a backlash against people who are seen as powerful, rich, privileged, the in crowd. There's a strong component in this election of down with whoever's up. So being too closely identified with the president while voters were still making up their mind about the president hurt the Democrat in Virginia and may have been one of the factors that hurt the Democrat in New Jersey. John Corzine was ahead in that race in the polls until the last week of the election, and he lost.
So, Al, going back a little bit, Al Gore in 2000 may have been wise not to campaign with Bill Clinton for this reason.
That's a tougher call. The problem Al Gore had, according to many people who've analyzed that campaign, was he didn't distance himself far enough from Clinton to save himself with the voters who disliked Clinton's personal behavior. But what he did do is distance himself enough from Clinton that he didn't get the benefit of those voters who thought 8 years of peace and prosperity under Bill Clinton wasn't such a bad deal. He kind of got the worst of both worlds there, and that, I think, is what Cree Deeds did in Virginia. He couldn't run away from from Barack Obama far enough, but he did manage to carry to retract all the animosity of people who were unhappy with Obama. In New Jersey, I think, again, the appearances by national figures on Corzine's behalf may have hurt him some, certainly did not help him much. But the most interesting election to me in this whole year, in terms of giving us any indication of what's going on nationally, was the 23rd Congressional District in upstate New York.
So that's one that I'm sure Democrats and Republicans watched very carefully.
Everybody was watching that because it was free of the other issues that cloud the picture in New Jersey and Virginia. Those were races for governor, not senator, certainly not president. They were issues of local interest that possibly overrode some of the national policy questions. But in the New York 23rd, this was clearly, do you want another Republican? It had been a Republican district. Or do you want a Democrat? And it evolved into, do you want a liberal-leaning Republican chosen by the party to appeal to the center in this swing district, or do you want a pure conservative? What happened was the pure conservative picked up enough steam that the Republican who'd been the choice of the party pulled out about a week before the election and threw her support to the Democrat as a protest against what the conservative Republicans had done to her. Partly to counter that and partly just to build on what they saw as this national building consensus against the administration, the Republicans brought in everybody to campaign in that district. I think they had Sarah Palin there at least twice, maybe three times. Several other very prominent Republicans. And it's clear
Campaigning for the
conservative party. And it's fairly clear from the direction the polls tracked there that the combination of the Republican pulling out, throwing a support to the Democrat, and a reaction against these national figures coming in tipped that district to the Democrats. So what I see here is not disaffection with Barack Obama so much as disaffection with whoever's in power.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what targeting is?
Yes. You've got an idea of how the population breaks down into smaller clusters, and which smaller clusters are the ones that will make a difference in your election. And ideally, what you'd like to do, well, let me take it back to when it was being done on little index cards with a hand calculator. You have precincts. Let's say you had an election, primary election, with three candidates for a nonpartisan office. And one of those candidates came in third, so now you have a runoff between the top two. And you're advising one of them about where to have the public appearances during the campaign. What I did, I found out later that I had independently reinvented something called persuadables targeting that was already in use by people much more experienced than I was and much better at it than I was, but I didn't do badly. First of all, identify chunks of voters, large numbers of voters, who had voted for that third candidate. These are people whose votes clearly are up for grabs. But then, the next thing I did was, well, look at how the votes split between you and your opponent in those neighborhoods. And what we want to do is take you to the places where there's a large number of these undecided voters, or not undecided voters, but uncommitted voters, voters who did turn out, but didn't turn out for either you or your opponent, but who are surrounded by people who are mostly favorable to you. Because after you appear, what's going to happen is they're all going to be talking to each other and saying, what did you think of that guy? And if what they're hearing around them is mostly, oh, we already liked him, you're more likely to pick them up. So what I did, simple calculation, was take the two candidates who were still in the race, what proportion of the vote did our guy get in this area? How many of the votes for this third party person, or this third person, were there, times that proportion? Okay, so if it was two-thirds, one-third in precinct A, and there were 100 voters for the third candidate there, and in precinct B there were 120 voters for the third candidate, but it was two-thirds, one-third the other way, the number we expected to persuade in the first precinct was two-thirds times 100, or 67. In the other precinct, it was one-thirds times 120, which is 40. Go to the precinct where you have somewhat fewer up for grabs, but you're more likely to get most of them.
So make sure that they turn out, convince them to come and vote.
Well, there are two things you do in targeting. One is trying to persuade people to support your candidate. And then the other is trying to persuade people you think are in favor of your candidate to get out and vote. And those are two different sets of targeting, and they're two different sets of actions. When you talk about persuading people, you probably want personal appearances by the candidate. Maybe you want some door-to-door campaigning. Maybe you want some telephone calling. Maybe you want some literature drops. Maybe you're trying to arrange some favorable media coverage that hit those areas primarily. But it's all about, what do these people care about? Let's let them know that our candidate has positions they like on the issues they care about. Get out the vote is a whole different story. Get out the vote is, how do we make sure that the people we think are for us will actually get to the polls? Often that involves offering them a ride to the polls, calling them a couple of times to remind them how important it is to vote, and please make sure you get to the polls today. Now, it helps if, when you do that, you have good enough real-time updating that you know who's voted, so you don't bug somebody who's already voted three more times, make sure you get to the polls today.
Because you can create disaffection and actually work against your own candidate.
That won't change the current election, because the person's already voted. But next time...
people have memories.
Yeah.
Let's return to the numbers. Are there any new developments in operations research, quantitative analytics that shed light on the political situation we're in right now?
There are a few. First of all, as I said, targeting is old. Trend analysis is old, somewhat newer. There have been some recent studies that I think are informative about how you predict the way elections go. One of the most interesting ones, and you know I've written about it, was done by a quantitative historian here in the Washington area, actually at American University, Alan Lichtman, who's a political scientist, a political historian by training.
Right, I think we'll talk about that a little bit more afterward, but
he has,
finish your point.
He did a model in collaboration with a Soviet seismologist. Again, throw out the ideology, throw out all the superstructure of this. The question is, can we tell whether the situation will remain stable or become unstable? And in that sense, a presidential election in which the challenger wins is not that different from an earthquake mathematically.
Well, that's an interesting thought.
That's where Alan Lichtman's 13 keys came from. It was the seismologist who came up with the idea. He kind of dragged Alan along with him. But it turns out that you can model, does it stay stable or do you get upheaval? And there are certain factors that remain pretty consistent, and you can get a pretty solid, stable model, which, unlike a lot of the other models out there, don't have to wait until 2 weeks before the election to tell you who's likely to win. The thing I find very impressive about the 13 keys model is that you can generally make, or Alan can generally make, a pretty good prediction. I'm going to say it, I want to go back to the first way. One who knows the model, you don't need Alan's expertise to interpret it. Someone who knows the model can make a pretty good prediction a year out, or 6 months out. And this is perhaps one of the most important points we can emphasize in a talk about OR. A model expresses people's expertise in a way that other people without that expertise can use and apply and get almost as good a result as the expert. That's what makes a model good.
Can you distinguish for our general listeners between operations research modeling and the standard polling and statistical analysis that most readers are familiar with?
Structure. Underlying structure. Polling gives you a snapshot of what people think in response to the questions you asked right now. If you looked at the polls in September of 2008, you'd have thought that McCain was slightly ahead. If you looked at the polls in August of 1992, you would have thought that George H.W. Bush was just about unbeatable.
I remember that was expressed at the time.
Yes, but not by Alan Lichtman, who had that election called for Bill Clinton as soon as Ross Perot came back into the race, because the presence or absence of a viable third-party candidate is one of the 13 keys. And that happened to be the one that tipped the balance, just in terms of number of keys. What you're looking for is the kind of structure in political behavior that tells you which way the polls are going to move if something happens, especially if that something is under your control as a campaigner. By the way, under 13 keys, it usually isn't.
We only have time for a few more questions. Let's turn from political handicapping to Homeland Security. Can you discuss your work on one specific Homeland Security scenario, the evacuation of stadiums and public places if there should actually be a terrorist attack?
Yes, I did what we call an agent-based simulation model.
You want to explain what that is?
Yes, I will. Of what it would take to get everybody out of a stadium if they all decided to leave at the same time with some sense of urgency. Simulation is basically you've got a situation, you don't know for sure a lot of the parameters of it, but you've got some probability densities, probability distributions that express your uncertainty about what might happen, a range of uncertainty. And what you do is take a whole lot of computer runs sampling from those probability distributions, so you get a number of instances of this randomly varying the inputs you're not sure about, and that gives you some outputs which also have a probability distribution, but the way that things usually work, that probability distribution, if you do enough runs, will be small enough that you can be reasonably precise about what's likely to happen. Now, in a typical computer simulation, the entities going through the simulation, for example, if we're simulating traffic presented to a telephone call center or customers arriving at a supermarket checkout line, we just assume that the customers don't think. They just move. They're entities moving through the system according to some set of rules. But what if they can think? What if they can learn from what's happening in front of them and say, there's a big line forming over there. Not only am I going to avoid that line, but I'm going to do a little thinking about where might be a better place to try next. So you can give the entities moving through the system some learning and adaptation capability. Maybe they can even learn how to learn, which would make them truly intelligent. If the entities in this moving through the system do have some learning capacity, we call them agents. And the programming is different. But the result still is you do a simulation with a whole lot of runs, and you come out with some idea of what's going to happen if. And you can vary certain inputs and say, well, if we did this differently, how much difference would that make? What we did in the stadium, we varied a couple of things. We varied whether people just kind of go to whatever exit they know about, either the closest one or the one they came in, or the usual choices. Or can we give them somewhat better information about which way to go, which exits would more likely be less crowded? And then the other thing we did was, do we let them all run out onto the field as soon as something happens, or do we keep them off the field? And what we were looking at as outputs for this were, first of all, how fast do people get out of the stadium? But then second, how much trampling and crush do we have? And how many people do we have getting injured by other people as they all try to get out?
That's a serious concern.
It is a serious concern because if you look at historical events where there was a mass evacuation of a stadium or a nightclub or some other public facility, in some of these cases, more people were injured or killed in the course of leaving than were injured by whatever the threat was that caused them to leave. So yes, this is a serious concern. And the way that we got into this, we didn't start out to do a study of mass egress. We started out to do a study for the Department of Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate of what kinds of technologies they should invest in to be of greatest help to incident commanders in dealing with bomb situations. They were thinking mostly in terms of detect, in advance, screen, defeat, the sorts of things you do before a bomb explodes. Hopefully you keep it from exploding, or at least you keep it from exploding where it will do a lot of damage and cause a lot of injury. And we did a focused workshop of incident commanders. What capabilities don't you have that you would most like to have? And they talked about a number of things, but what one of them said was, when we give people an order to evacuate, we get much better compliance if when we give the order we can tell them which way to go. Can you help us with that? And the little light bulb went on over my head, and I said, yeah, I think I see a way to do that.
So what solution did you come up with?
Some of the solutions I came up with I am not at liberty to discuss with you,
okay.
But certainly one of the solutions that suggested itself very strongly is, in some situations, and a stadium is one of them, where unlike an airplane or a boat, which were some of the other things we thought a lot more about, it's not about to crash, catch fire, sink. A stadium doesn't burn very well. If the attack is a couple of suicide vests, probably the best thing people can do is just hunker down in front of their seats and stay there until they're told it's all clear. Moving around makes them better targets. And
that's very interesting.
And that is something we recommended, and it is something that I can tell you publicly we recommended. And another thing we recommended is some attention to how certain routes are handled. One of the big problems with an evacuation is that often the whole place is designed with an idea of how fast people could get out if everybody wanted to leave at the same time. Architects and facilities designers do think about this sort of thing, but what they don't think about is, what if at that very same time a whole bunch of first responders are trying to come in?
And I remember seeing that in New York City during the first attack on the World Trade Center, where one of the tunnels was closed and the first responders were coming through the closed tunnel in order to respond.
This was an issue in the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center as well, some first responders trying to go up stairways that everybody else was trying to go down.
So returning to the stadium, you said you had a second thing that you could discuss with us, a recommendation.
Well, certainly one big recommendation is that better guidance to exits helps a lot. Letting them go onto the field helps some because it does two things. One, they've got more places to go, and two, they feel safer. So the sense of urgency about leaving will be less, and a sense of urgency about having to get out is what causes people to walk over other people. But better guidance to exits, and there are ways to do that, would be a significant improvement. We know that red signs up high are a bad way to tell people where the exits are, because smoke rises and it blocks the red end of the spectrum first. In airplanes, we know we want blue lights on the floor. In a stadium, blue lights on the floor wouldn't cost that much, and they'd be a lot more effective. Another thing that would be more effective, it's even better because smoke blocks light but not sound. There are some sound devices that are more in use in Europe than here, although I understand there are some now employed in the United States as well, that are very good at indicating to people which way to go. That would help. Those things would help.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Dr. Douglas Samuelson, president of the consulting firm Infologix. Doug, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Barry.
And thank you for listening to the Science at Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and this series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.